Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow.
All right, everybody. Welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. Michelle, I still have my little cold, but I'm feeling pretty good.
Huh? You sound like you got a little frog in your throat.
Well, that's exactly right, but it's coming around. You see, I'm feeling pretty good right now after that little bout I had here, you know, when it was wintertime.
When it was wintertime.
Hey, y'all, welcome again to Start It Up, the best tasting show on radio. It's so nice to have all of you here with us. We appreciate you taking time to come sit at the kitchen table with us today and bring that hot cup of coffee. By the way, you thinking about my Valentine's Day gift? Right around the corner, huh?
I didn't give you enough for Christmas or what?
Christmas, that was months ago.
I see.
That was months ago.
Well, I guess I need to start thinking.
Christmas is so far in my rearview mirror, I can't even think about it. Huh? And it's almost Christmas again. Huh? No, it's almost Easter. Oh, I'll tell you, it's almost everything.
It's just a holiday all year long.
Well, anyway, so how have you been? Good?
Very well. Did you see what I'm wearing today?
Well, yeah, I do.
My little scarf?
Yeah, I see that little scarf you got on.
I'm going to tell you about
like
it in a
little,
minute.
You look like you're a little Scottish or something.
Yeah,
like
I know. Right, huh? A little Scotch-Irish.
Well, why do you have that on today? It's not in there. What, it's not St. Patty's Day yet.
Well, I was just kind of feeling my roots.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Oh, Slama.
The roots.
Slama, she shook me so much, I didn't even tell you good day.
Oh.
She shook me so much, I didn't even acknowledge that you were in the room. How you doing over there, Slama?
I'm well.
See that she's been kind of flipping this little scarf around her neck all morning? And I guess that was enticing me to ask why.
Why?
Now, all of a sudden, this Coniglio, who's come from Italy, Coniglio on the Ligura, on a ship, $40, you got cardboard suitcases, it's claiming to be Scots-Irish.
Okay.
That's where the York comes in. That's the other side of the family.
Oh, I see.
Now, this isn't exactly a York tartan.
I see.
But, you know, because we have our own.
You have your own.
We have our own. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I bet it is.
There's a Scottish version and an American version.
Yeah, I bet there is. Slama, the Falses have that tartan, too.
Oh, now, please.
We have our tartan color. It's green. It's brown. It's got some little wavy stuff. And some people call it camouflage.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I'm not wearing any plaid today. Is I'm wearing my camouflage.
You
that's
blend our, right in.
That's our Scottish background.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, January 25th, you know, this time of year, is the birthday of that famous Scottish bard, Robert Burns.
Right.
You know him, the poet, the author of our favorite New Year's song, Auld Lang Syne.
Yep, that's a good one.
Yeah, throughout his very short life, he wrote poetry that celebrated his love of the Scottish heritage and its rural culture and traditions. Actually, he's considered the national poet of Scotland. And one of his famous works is his Address to a Haggis. How about that? No comment?
Address to a Haggis.
Yes, I thought you would appreciate that.
I was more into Robert Burns for my love is like a red rose rather than a Haggis. You know, I thought I loved, my love like a red rose, that newly sprung of June. That's what I think of.
You're
talking about a stuffed stomach.
You know, Caledonian societies have Robert Burns supper
events. They do. I'm surprised you're so into all this.
Well, I'm telling you, we've been talking about these historic dinners that we're starting to do with the Culinary Institute. So I was thinking ahead, we're doing one this spring celebrating the national anthem, and I just thought, looking ahead, we might want to have a Robert Burns supper. Some haggis.
So while you're sitting here kind of touting haggis, do you know what haggis is?
One time.
You had it one time.
Well,
for people who really talk so bad about fruitcakes during Christmas and haggis during spring, I should mention that we in Louisiana are pretty fond of all items fairly similar to that Scottish-Irish haggis, as you mentioned. I guess it's all about celebrating your culinary heritage, although haggis isn't exactly a well-known food.
It's much more exotic just to say haggis and maybe not explain what it is.
Well, if you think of a panse, a pulse in Cajun country is a stuffed stomach with ingredients, like a pork stomach. All
right. Right.
And it's stuffed with ground meats and onions and celery and all of that. And it's similar in some ways to what would be considered the family of Boudins and Andouilles in Louisiana. But in his poem, Burns calls the haggis the great chieftain or the pudding race.
Because it's technically a pudding.
Blood pudding is Boudin, too. Blood pudding is sausage. I mean, pudding in that part of the world is referring to a ground force meat of some type, and that's why they call it pudding, because it's kind of held together loosely, like a Boudin. Would be haggis is the minced organs, so you're talking about organ meat, kidneys, lights, which is like lungs, heart.
Liver,
which the Cajuns call the debris. So when everybody starts hollering about how bad the haggis is, we have our debris, which is a stew made with all of these organ meats. We dilute them in a stew. We dilute them in a sauce pecan. So, you know, we get away with it. But they just kind of grind all of these organ meats together and mix them with onions and fat and spices. And, of course, they put stock in there. But this is the issue. They fill it up with oats and grain. So hold on before you get on.
That's good for you.
Yeah, but imagine what it does. This kind of like this solid mix of everything you want to throw away. And now you're going to cook it and eat it. So you see what I'm talking about? Anyway, all kidding aside, it is. I think it's the oats and the grain that take this meat and turn it into another thing that many people might not admire. But it is much like our sausages and boudins. As the good French Cajuns know, boudin noir, the blood sausage, is called black pudding and was always called black pudding here. And it kind of brings us full circle around to what the haggis would be without the oats. So when you hear how bad the haggis is, they're right.
That's not fair.
No, it's traditional. Well, remember Andouillettes when we were in the south of France?
Okay, that's a whole different story.
No, it's not. It's the same thing. It's casings inside of casings, and it kind of had the smell of that.
Yeah, it had a smell. That's what I recollect.
Well, that's organ meats. Organ meats tend to have their own scent about them, you know?
That was 7 years ago today that I had that encounter with the Andouillette.
Hey, welcome to the haggis.
You know, the oldest recipe for black pudding dates to early A.D. and the writings of the ancient culinarian Apicius.
Of course.
And, of course, use the intestine rather than the stomach to encase the heavily spiced and minced entrails, the blood, the oats, the fats that you were talking about. Through the Middle Ages, stuffing-type savory puddings remained a common dish for the rich and poor, and eventually it became associated with England and Anglo cooking.
And also the winter and the butchery season of the year when people were killing the animals. Of course you weren't going to get rid of anything but the squeal in a pig, and you certainly weren't going to get rid of the feathers from a chicken. I mean, everything went into some useful process. So certainly the organ meats would have been served on their own, like liver, like we do today, smothered liver and onions, or a kidney stew or whatever. But as you know, also cleaning the intestines or stomach of the animals was never an easy task. The pudding cloth was a remedy for that. It was a linen cloth used to loosely tie up this kind of suet-based mixture. Suet means just kind of this all mixed together with fat in it, you know. Then it was boiled in water, sometimes with meat added to it, and then turned out onto a plate. They could then be sliced like a boudin and placed in the heart, you know, the fireplace, under the cooking meat to be flavored further by the drippings of, say, a roast or a leg of lamb or something like that. So when you think of putting boudin together, or you think of hogshead cheese coming together and then it's gelling and you're slicing it, and just think of all of this in the same family, and maybe just from another world.
You know, you see the influence of the English early in Louisiana and the Felicianas, which were heavily Anglo, having been settled by the Scots and the Irish and the English. The breads and cheeses of their dinners were often served with an accompaniment of a pottage or porridge or pudding made from the broth and drippings of the meats mixed with oats or barley.
There you go again.
Mm-hmm. You know, these types of puddings were really more of a pastry-based dish rather than the French Buddha that was, you know, the intestine
encased. Anyway, Yorkshire pudding, y'all, probably the best known of all British pudding dishes, is one that's certainly pastry-based. It's baked rather than boiled, and it's made with a simple mixture of eggs, flour, milk, and it's just kind of whipped into a batter. And then when the pan of roast comes out of the oven and there's all the natural drippings of the meat in the bottom of the pan, the roast is taken out and put off to the side on a platter to cool. And now the dumplings, these Yorkshire puddings, go down into the sizzling fat of the pan, back into the oven, and they bake, and it's a regular shape because there's nothing to hold them together. It's just like a piece of bread. So the Yorkshire pudding becomes a pastry, like a bread, that's baked inside the drippings of the meat pan that picks up all of those flavors while they bake, and then it comes to the table and you just break off pieces of it like we did at the Falls family.
That
just
sounds delicious. How come you've never made me a Yorkshire pudding?
And, well, today they have these beautiful little Yorkshire pudding muffin tins that's kind of about 3 inches deep, and they got a nice fluted top to them, so you put the batter in there with a tablespoon of the beef drippings down in the bottom of the cup, then you put it into that 375 degree oven and they puff right out of the top. They call them puffs a lot of times rather than Yorkshire pudding, the correct name. Who would eat a puff? I'd never do it, huh? I'm telling you right now. Anyway, these wonderful flavors would, I mean, they were fairly inexpensive, and of course you could use the drippings of the pan rather than a butter or oil to create these puddings. A lot of times they'd be cooked in a skillet right next to the fireplace, and again, you'd have all of these different shapes. A lot of times they call them dipping puddings too, because they picked up all of the great flavor. So
there's another savory pudding dish that was popular in the 18th century called a marrow pudding.
Oh yeah,
which sounds a lot like a tart or a pie. The ingredients varied from marrow to almonds, carrots, chestnuts, lemons, and the delicate flavor of rose water baked in a pie-like crust with a decorative crust on top. That sounds delicious.
Well, y'all, I think what you're hearing is that once the English got to Louisiana, and we started to see a lot of changes in many of the dishes that we would consider a pudding or a sausage. That's what we're talking about today, and you don't want to miss anything. We have a great guest who's an
expert.
We
have a great guest.
So anyway, y'all, don't miss anything. Today we're talking about puddings, but not bread puddings. You don't want to miss it. Welcome back, everybody, to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, the best culture show on radio as well. And today we're talking, as you can tell from the music, we're talking about puddings of every kind. And of course, here in the swamplands of Louisiana, none better than our red boudins and our andouilles and our pasta stuffed stomachs. That's just, we just absolutely love them. It's so nice to have all of you with us again around the kitchen table with your cup of coffee. And Michelle, every now and then we hit on the right person. You know, it's not often. I said every now and again because
we've been on a winning streak lately.
Look, let me tell you something. Remember we were in New York back in December and we ran into Kathy Kaufman over there.
Yes.
How great she was.
Had a great visit with Kathy Kaufman.
And Michelle, please introduce our guest. She is a wonderful lady, and I cannot wait to chat with her.
I know. We have Lynn Olver with us today, founder of The Food Timeline.
Isn't that a great piece?
The Food Timeline is a website containing links to sources on the origins of foods and historic recipes. What an asset. Lynn has been a trusted resource for thousands of students. Thousands of chefs, food writers, culinary historians who seek information on the topic, and it's a resource we look to often for accurate historic food facts.
Now that's the key right there, accurate.
Accurate, because there's a lot of myth. Lynn started The Food Timeline in 1999 and is at the helm of it every day. She enjoys the thrill of the hunt, and I so know what she means about that, the thrill of the hunt, because I call it Discovering the Motherlode. She admits she has always been naturally curious. Between 1999 and 2010, she answered more than 21,000 food history questions. Let me be more specific. 21,239 food history questions. That is the exact number, because as a good librarian always does, Lynn has all of these numbered and cataloged for future access. I love that.
I know what you wish. You wish you'd have been born into our family. I can see it on your face. Huh?
Maybe she could come and visit and get all of our records cataloged and archived. Lynn, welcome to Stirring It Up. You can see we're so excited to have you today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So with a background in library science, what drew you to food?
Well, as a professional reference librarian working in a public library, I'm used to answering questions from all walks of life and all ages and stages of people. And I have naturally been a foodie from birth. So creating the food timeline is actually the perfect convergence of my professional training and my personal passion. As you said, every day I love waking up and getting questions I've never had before, because it is truly the thrill of the hunt.
So what kind of questions do you get? I guess every day is different, but is there a pattern?
There are seasonal patterns. During the holidays, I specialize in what I call recipe recovery. A lot of people want to remake mom's or grandma's or great-grandma's favorite holiday dish, and they realized after they moved, you know, they've misplaced the family cookbook, or they're trying to reach back into family traditions. So I do what I can with my library to match up everything they remember with the recipe that they're looking for. The great majority of food questions are basic recipe history. I need the history behind the tuna melt, or I need the history behind, you know, roast beef, and or what, you know, why do we have eggs and bacon for breakfast, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asked for historic menus. A lot of chefs and party planners, caterers, are looking to plan a 1920s theme party, or because of Mad Men, a lot of people were looking for 1960s theme parties, so I can help with authentic menus and recipes. Ingredient origins, where did cherries come from? Who invented the maraschino cherry, or is there such a thing naturally? Get questions on dining etiquette, and sometimes that's, you know, why do restaurants serve free bread at the beginning of the meal, which is very interesting because that does not hold true in every place and every time. And so it's a wonderful gift of questions from the public.
Well, Lynn, you know, as writers ourselves and researchers, I mean, we're constantly, as Michelle calls it, the mother load. I know when Michelle is out doing research, right now we're doing a new book for the next season, and it's all about vegetables. We go in our books, as you know, go back way into the history, all the way to cave drawings, if possible. We always have source issues, and we're always anxious to find that document. What are the sources you use? I mean, you've just listed so many wonderful questions that's so obvious that people would love to know the source of. What's your sources for the research?
Well, the sources depend upon the question. And I have in my living room, which has been retermed the book room, I have ready access to about 2,500 culinary histories and historic cookbooks, writings, government documents, Department of Agriculture, yearbooks, that kind of thing. Newspapers and magazine databases often provide the evolution of first instance of an ingredient or a particular dish with regards to U.S. introduction. Anything you find in a cookbook is naturally Americanized, so to speak. But
right, right,
you
sure.
will find instances in the media before it shows up in the standard sources. I use magazines and newspaper databases for food advertisements. And what were the original flavors of fruit stripe gum was a question I had this week. And that's the only place where you're going to find it. And it was fabulous because the actual flavors have changed over the years. So it's not a standard set thing. I'll go into intellectual property and trademark databases to find dates for the first official use of a particular brand name, product name. And I have a wonderful network of culinary experts that I can draw upon depending upon the question.
Lynn, I'm looking at your book room right now on your website.
Yeah, that really, and that's only one view. I need to get the 360 view.
I encourage everybody who wishes to be near Lynn to just listen to her talk about history, to hope to sit on that brown couch one day that's sitting on the right-hand side right there.
It is wonderful, and it also, the book room comes with two cats.
Well, Michelle has the cat in her book room, and I have the dog in my book room, so we know exactly what you're talking about. Lynn, how did pudding, we're talking about pudding today, and of course in Louisiana when we talk about pudding, it's bread pudding with whiskey sauce, you know, but since we have such an unbelievable English side of Louisiana, seven nations of Creole settling Baton Rouge, our state capital in St. Francisville, certainly puddings are really strongly associated with British cuisine, at least in our mind. So is that part of that origin, or did all cultures, all cooks have puddings as part of their culinary repertoire?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And, you know, you really hit spot on when it comes to a global type of cuisine, because almost every culture does have something similar. But the British claim that pudding is their own, and they can do it quite rightly, I believe. Basically, puddings, pulses, potage is a form of pudding, which is kind of a grains and legumes. They're mixed up in a pot. The earliest form of pudding, actually dating back to ancient Rome, and of course we know the Romans invaded Britain, were more like sausages. And so they would be mixed up meats with spices and grains. And that's the form of pudding that haggis descends from. There's also British blood puddings and white puddings and things like that. And as cooking technology changed, in England especially, fuel was plentiful. So you had trees, you had forests. So having a pudding and having an open kettle and open pot served dual purpose. It was a cooking utensil, but it also served to warm the house or warm the cottage and things like that. So that's why you find a lot of pudding traditions, boiled pudding, peas porridge from the nursery rhyme fits into that. You know, the 9 days old, today we would think, oh, that's stale and yucky. But back then you would have the kettle on constantly because you would be adding new things to it. You'd be adding new pulses, new grains. If you had a little bit of meat, eating meat every day is a relatively modern thing. Back in the old days, you didn't have that so much. The invention of the pudding cloth around the beginning of the 19th century was a British thing, and that allowed for the whole family of boiled puddings and Christmas puddings and plum puddings and figgy puddings and things like that.
Well, I know I had an opportunity. It was a great opportunity to cook in England for a time, and especially around once the cold set in, riding through the countryside, stopping at some of the taverns, of course, working in the hotels, walking into the shops. I mean, it certainly gave you a new appreciation for the word pudding because, as you say, I mean, that was the time of year when the kettles were rolling and there was a lot of things wrapped in cheesecloth going into kettles, etc. That was new and extremely exciting to me, even though we in Louisiana have cranked up the large cauldrons, the cast iron pots over wood fires for many years, not only to do our boucheries and our boudins and all of that, but also the tradition, as you just mentioned, of making use of that pot for multiple reasons, as we did with our red beans and rice, cooking it down into these pots on wash day where there was multiple use for the kettle, so to speak. So it's very interesting that as you were talking, it brought back a lot of great memories, not only from here in the swamps of Louisiana, but also from the streets and countryside of England. At what time in history would you say that puddings made a change from, and I guess there's so many savory still today, but made that great change from savory to sweet as we think about using up our day-old bread in our beautiful southern bread puddings?
That's an interesting question, because puddings, as we talked about before, there are so many different definitions of puddings, and they all run parallel histories. But if I had to pick a general time point where the general populace started contexting pudding as a sweet as opposed to a savory, it would be in the 18th century. And that is when you have the proliferation of creams and custards and pudding pies, and the natural iteration from that was also ice cream. And in the United States, it was about the mid-19th century, so it was a little later when puddings became considered more of a sweet than a savory. And some of that had to do with the evolution of pudding technology, the introduction of custard powder in the mid-19th century. Alfred Bird, he really was a turning point for the sweet puddings.
Hmm.
Of course, you know, those of us, I'm a baby boomer generation. So before I started researching pudding, the only pudding if you asked me what was pudding, I would say it comes from a box and it's chocolate. And you cook it on the stove, you add milk. And the only other time I had ever heard of pudding would be in Christmas carols. Bring me a figgy pudding.
But yeah, right.
I never really had any context. I had no idea what that was. But I knew it belonged to a holiday in England. Mm-hmm. But that's it.
You know, a lot of times when we run across things like that, it becomes so inspiring. You know, sometimes I'll find an old recipe and bring it to John, and he'll say, oh, well, we have to make this. So do you ever find yourself doing that when you uncover a historic recipe or something interesting from the past? Do you run to the kitchen to start whipping it up?
It depends. I have no professional training in hearth cookery or as a chef. So I have been known to go back as far as maybe the 1930s, because the recipes are all modern then. And sometimes, yes, sometimes I'll research something, and then I will have to make it just because I'm interested to see what the original recipe tastes like. And one of the best examples of that was the original Betty Crocker lemon bars from 1963. So I have the actual cookbook. I make it, and the great thing is where I work, people love to eat. So I'll bring the original recipe, and I will have them taste it. Because if you go back further than the 1930s, the recipe instructions get a little different, and food was a little bit different. So you're never sure if you're making apples to apples, so to speak. I have been in some historic hearth cooking classes, and those people absolutely blow my mind. I have so much respect for them, because they actually take a recipe from Hannah Glass, or they'll take an early 19th century recipe, and they won't just try to approximate it in the kitchen. They literally will cook it with the instructions the way it was done back then.
There's nothing John loves better than to cook something in his open hearth. I mean, that's his. He has a whole culinary antique collection, Lynn, that you have to come and see.
Wow. I'm so jealous.
My good friend Jean-Louis Paladin actually got me started on open hearth cooking about 25 years ago, and just sent me on this journey into just ecstasy, because I found equipment all over the world, from the Hasteners all the way to all the clock wound rotisseries, all of that. And I love nothing more than on Christmas Day, to fire up. I built a fireplace in my home that you can walk into just for that purpose. And nothing's better on Christmas Day than to see a leg of lamb or something rolling on the rotisserie. I'm so glad you mentioned that. When were you stumped? I mean, you're in the business of finding out all of the answers. Anything ever stump you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes it stumps me. I can give you some examples, but sometimes I'm stumped because I'm limited to English language sources.
Yes.
I can read a little bit of French, but, you know, if we're talking German or Czech or Russian, then I need to go to my experts. Sometimes I'm stumped because the question is set in current context, and I have to help people understand, you know, the questions you're asking today don't apply to the Middle Ages. You know, for example, sometimes I'll get a question about, you know, what kind of ice creams or what kind of desserts did the peasants eat in the Middle Ages? They didn't have dessert. So, you know, they ate potage. You know, they ate, you know, once a day, twice a day if they were lucky. And sometimes I'm really, you know, surprised because you think that the answer is going to be immediate and pop right out because it seems so obvious there must be an answer to the question. And I'm led on a journey. And this week, a perfect example is, what is the origin or who coined the term, first you eat with your eyes? And you go to the quote books and you won't find it. You go to the standard sources, you won't find it. You'll see a lot of mentions of it. And the source I used to answer that, and of course, we all think, oh, Brillat Savarin,
right,
or MFK Fisher or Carême. But no, there's nothing there. And Barry Popick has this wonderful website called The Big Apple, where he's a linguist and etymologist, and he studies word and phrase origins. And his site is available also without charge on the Internet. Fabulous source. And he traced the origins of this to 18th century Chinese gastronomes.
Oh, but, my gosh.
So I'm still looking for the exact source. So that question isn't done yet, but it's a wonderful start. And if you Google it, you get all sorts of, you know, less than informational answers.
Lynn, I'm going to ask you, would you mind holding on? We have to take a quick hard break right now, but if you can hold on just a minute, we'll come back. Will you stay with us?
Certainly.
Okay, good. Y'all, we'll be back in a minute. You don't want to miss any of what Lynn has to say on this subject. It's fascinating. We'll see you back in a minute.
To see, to find my shaky pudding and bring her back to me, boys. Bring her back to me.
My baby's recipe. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Stirring It Up. I told you it was the best tasting show on Radio Slama. You have great music today on the show, Era. The searching out pudding songs cannot be easy. You do
oh,
a great...
but it's a pleasure.
That was a classic, wasn't it?
That was a good one. Yeah, that goes way back.
Anyway, you know, one thing about doing a radio show in the New Orleans area is that we have such great access, not only to the food, but to the music on the show. And we get as much written about the music as we do about the topic, you know. So thank you, Slama, for your great work on music research.
It's a pleasure.
Anyway, Michelle, what a great guest we have with us today. And
that's right.
She's agreed, to allow us to capture her for another. Go across the break here. So now you can take off.
Lynn, thank you so much for holding over. I think we kind of cut you off on your story. First, we eat with our eyes. So you're still researching that and trying to find the source?
Correct. I'm still working on that, and that will be interesting because I have a feeling that it's possible that the original source has not yet been translated or widely translated from the Chinese. I have a number of questions where they're still open-ended, and I do keep copies, as you mentioned in the beginning. I do catalog all of my answers, and I keep paper copies with all of the documentation I've used to answer. So when I stumble on the rest of that answer, I can pull it up and actually send it off to the person who requested. Sometimes I get questions that I think there's no way I'm going to find an answer. There is absolutely no way. And again, because it seems like the question is contexted in today's, you know, society and not the way it was back then. But I'm amazed and surprised. I was asked this week, how much did strawberries cost in 1856? And I'm thinking immediately, well, why would they cost anything? People had gardens and they were seasonal and you would just grow your strawberries. And I did a research in the historical newspapers. And in 1856, the New York Times published this super detailed market data on the new strawberry crops. They were trying to encourage people to grow strawberries as a cash crop. And so there was pricing data and how the strawberries were sold in baskets and bushels And the fact that the baskets in New York were dirty and the baskets in Boston were clean and sanitary. And a basket was 12.5 cents. So I'm just floored. I was like, well, there is an answer to this question. So, you know, again, from the librarian standpoint, never say never.
Len, a lot of times when we're researching topics, as you do every day, I guess, in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and it'll be on my mind about this question, just as you just said, who said this? And it drives me insane. I just cannot get it off of my mind. And you just jump up in the morning, you go back to the site and you start to look again. How do you make it a life's work out of this? I mean, do you get a good night's sleep?
Never. I do the same thing. Only with this question about you eat with your eyes, I kept, you know, mentally saying, because I woke up in the middle of the night. I said, check for REM, check for REM. And, you know, that was the first thing I did. I am still a working professional librarian. I am actually the library director at the Morris County Library in Whippany, New Jersey. That is my full-time job. And when I come home, then I have my other full-time job, which is the food timeline.
Oh, that's
which it's an invaluable resource. Have you considered turning it into a for-profit business?
Well, my husband has.
I bet he has.
At this point, I'm just delighted, and I think it goes back to my public library roots. As a public librarian, I want to, you know, make information available and free, you know, to everyone. So if you have a third grader, I want him to ask me questions as much as somebody who is a professional chef. And if I started, you know, a charging model, then I'm afraid that some of the people who really want and deserve the information might be excluded. On the flip side of that, I am available for hire contract for in-depth research projects. I recently engaged with Cook's Country to do a research for this season's shows. So, and because that requires a different level of commitment. And
sure.
So I think when I retire from my primary job, then I will probably follow that model.
You offer such an not only a valuable but an extremely unique service, because I mean all of us are just miserable in searching out information daily as we write and study and produce, publish all the things that we do. Michelle and I are not only in radio, but we have a national PBS show that just about to kick off again, and we'll be doing the taping on for Fishing out of our book Hooks, Lies, and Alibis, The History of Fishing.
Oh, I love that.
And I guarantee you, not only will we be asking you to come and be our friend and play around Louisiana, which is so much fun to do when you and your husband have a chance to do it and come and be our guest, but also I know we're going to be chatting with you more just in our professional careers as well. I do want to make sure also that as part of your library, you have all of our big books, I should say. I don't know if you only have my encyclopedia or whether you have my After the Hunt, which is the history of hunting, or whether you have our Hooks, Lies, and Alibis, and of course the vegetable books coming out. We'd certainly love to make sure you get a copy of those if you don't have them all. So.
Oh, I would welcome that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You know, I receive no funding, so all of the books that I have are out-of-pocket expenses, and I would be absolutely honored and delighted to add your books to my collection.
Well, we're going to make sure we do that, Michelle. We're going to send that to you. And anyway, we cannot thank you enough, Len. You've been a lot of fun, but not only fun. You are a perfect guest for Starting It Up, and we cannot thank you enough for taking the time to be with us
today. Oh, and thank you. I think you provided us with some information, too, in our search for President James Madison menus. I think we kind of picked your brain or picked your sight on that. So thank you for your help as well.
Excellent.
It's been great to have you with us today. We look forward to meeting you, and we'll definitely get these books in the mail to you. And I hope you'll plan a trip to Louisiana very soon.
I think I have to now. now I have friends down there.
That's it.
And Lynn, we only offer sincere invitations. So make sure you take us up on it, okay? Thank you so much.
I will. Thank you so much for having me as your guest. It really has been an honor and a pleasure.
Well, next time we come up north, we're going to give you a call. Maybe we'll get a chance to meet and have lunch in the city, okay?
Lovely. That would be perfect.
All right, everybody. What a great guest Lynn has been. By the way, all of her information will be available on our website, as it is each week. We make sure that we include all of this, of course, on our facebook.com/stirringitupradio page as well. We'll have information on Lynn on our little facts and figures section.
Yeah.
So Salama, what about Facebook? Anything going on? Anything new? You see my melatons are starting to sprout.
Yeah, and the pictures of them are sprouting as well. I mean, folks, you got to come check out this Facebook page. It is the absolute best Facebook page. The best page on the internet. If you are on the internet, you need to come by and check out Stirring It Up Radio, the Facebook page, which is our public forum where we encourage our stovehounds and otherwise come on by and give us some great advice on how to keep this show simmering.
Like
Michelle Yard, any resources or books on the subject of our topic today?
Well, you know, the Brits are famous for these unusual turns of phrase or names of dishes in particular. So the first book that I want to recommend, I'm going to alter the name just a little bit. So everybody is going to have to go to the website to get the actual name. But it's How to Make Spotted
Dick and Other Suet Puddings. That's by Jeff Wells, and it's a great book on all sausages and puddings and all of that. And when I was in England, let me tell you what, you'd go in the store windows, and there it was, suet puddings and spotted dick right next to it in the window.
And there you go. That's
well, you know,
that's,
the
well food, I know it's the name. Strange it's names? Just a very odd name, so thank you for
taking that.
Well,
not odd name to the English. Huh?
This is volume 10 of the best-selling series, Authentic English Recipes.
Yeah.
The author, Jeff Wells, is from a small town outside of London and has reproduced all the wonderful traditional pudding recipes that the English are famous for. Among the sweet and savory recipes that you'll find, there's one in particular that you'll recognize, figgy pudding. And Lynn was just referencing that earlier. These recipes will have you saying, pip, pip, and cheerio all the way home.
I'm not sure of that.
The next book I think you'll enjoy is Puddings A to Z, Sweet and Savory Puddings, Custards, Flans, and Mousses. This was written by Marie Simmons, an award-winning author, teacher, passionate cook. Marie has over 5 cookbooks to her credit. She's a frequent contributor to Cooking Light, Prevention Magazine, Cottage Living, as well as Eating Well. In Puddings A to Z, you'll find recipes for sweet and savory, what I like to say, curl up on the sofa puddings.
Oh,
so,
I like those.
Oh, yeah, starting with, you know, the humble staples of eggs and bread and, you know, all those yummy things. Marie has brought together 40 favorite recipes. She includes flans. She includes a savory corn pudding. Good.
You like that, huh?
Yes, indeed. So we're going to have all of the information on both books on our website, jfols.com. Great additions to your culture and culinary library. And kind of an interesting thing to play around with during this chilly season. Make an unusual pudding for the table.
Well, I mean, it's that time of year. This is pudding time of year. All of this information, of course, will be on our website. Michelle, talking about puddings, I do have some savory. I have my corn and ham pudding, which I absolutely love because it's a great side dish to steak or to roasted chicken or even a good fish dish. Mm-hmm. And I also have an old-time oyster pudding. A lot of people might not particularly care for oysters.
But I know that's got to be one of your favorites.
Oh, it's got to be one of my favorites because it's just chopping up the oysters and kind of sautéing them with the onions and the garlic and all that, adding mushrooms, and then, of course, a little whole milk going into that and eggs. So, I mean, it's a great, great recipe. I'm going to certainly put the old-time oyster pudding recipe on the website because oysters are in this time of year.
Yeah.
And you don't want to miss them. And it only takes about 6 dozen oysters to make a
six dozen.
Would you like me to do the old-time oyster pudding for you, or would you like me to do the corn and ham pudding? Which one would you like, huh? I think the corn and ham is probably something more people would make on the
regular. Yeah, I like the corn and ham.
Yeah, because you can make that all year long, and corn's coming in pretty soon, next couple months. You're going to have fresh corn on the cob,
because
right?
It's spring.
It's spring
Slava,
already,
it's spring.
All it's springtime, huh? Anyway, y'all, you know, combining vegetables, Michelle, with smoked meats has always been just commonplace here in Louisiana. But combining, you know, these flavors with cream and eggs to create that custard, which, of course, is the origin of pudding, as you well know, kind of holding things together, to create, you know, these kind of souffle dishes or these casserole dishes, fairly new to Louisiana, using the vegetables. And, of course, you could put seafood in this as well. Mm-hmm. You can do a corn and shrimp pudding or a corn and crab pudding or corn
good.
Ham and crab pudding, because the smokiness comes from the ham, right? Y'all, you're going to begin with about 6 or 7 ears of corn, which is going to give you about 3 cups of corn. So you can also use canned corn if you like. If you use canned corn, I like the whole frozen, it to me is better. But if you want to use canned, it is canned in the height of the season. I always like to use the light shoe peg with the dark golden corn as well. That way you have the 2 different varieties in the pudding. You're going to have about 6 slices of bacon. And, of course, you're going to render that and render the fat from that bacon. You're going to preheat your oven to 375. And in the saute pan, you're going to fry the bacon to render the fat. You're going to remove those 6 slices of bacon. You're going to chop it up and just kind of set it aside. And then into that, I'd put about 1/2 cup of finely minced ham. I drop it into those bacon drippings once the bacon is all chopped up and done. And once that's nice, you take it out as well. It's going to add the smoke along with the wonderful flavor of the bacon. And then into that same oil from the bacon fat, you're going to go ahead and saute 1 cup of diced onions, 1/2 cup of diced celery, 1/4 cup of diced yellow bell peppers, 1/4 cup of red bell peppers, 1/4 cup of minced garlic. You're going to saute all of that around wonderfully, and once it's all coming together, then you're going to throw that into a large mixing bowl. You're going to add to that 1 cup of milk, 3 eggs beaten. You're going to add 1/4 cup of butter because there's not enough oil from the bacon. You want to make it nice. Well, Michelle, this is a wonderful pudding. This is a holiday treat. You're going to throw a pinch of thyme and basil in there. You're going to throw a little salt, pepper, granulated garlic. You're going to pinch in a little salt, pepper, and kind of mix all of that together as well. And the eggs and the milk, then you're going to toss the corn in, those 3-4 cups of corn. You're going to mix all of that together with the bacon that's been chopped in the ham. So if you think about it, you've sauteed the ham and bacon, you rendered the fat, you took that out, you sauteed the onion, celery, bell pepper, garlic. The bell peppers are colored for beauty. You're going to take that out. You're going to put it all in a big bowl. You're going to throw the corn in there. You're going to throw the milk. It cools it all down. Then you mix the 3 eggs in, you put your thyme, your basil, your salt, your pepper, your granulated garlic. Pop it in a 375-degree oven, y'all, in one of those really nice oiled baking dishes. You know the ones I'm talking about. And then I like to place it in a pan with about 1 inch of water. So I put it in a bigger pan, 1 inch of water. You're kind of creating a water bath.
Why do you do that?
That's to keep it from burning or scorching. The custard has to cook gently. So you put it in a water bath and it's going to make that happen.
Kind of a little sauna.
That's exactly what it's doing. It's steaming around it. So that 375-degree oven, it's going to be in there about 45 minutes before it all sets nicely. You take it out. And I love to serve it warm, but you can also freeze it. It does really well, too. But anyway, y'all, hit recipe on the website, also for my old-time oyster pudding. We had a great, great show today. Puddings are in. I wouldn't necessarily think that you should start off with the haggis, but maybe a little blood boudin will get you into it. We'll see you next week.